Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. When we talk about travel nightmares, we often picture what lurks outside. Dark alleys, strangers with bad intentions, stories that begin with a missed train or a wrong turn. But sometimes, danger is already inside. Today, we're opening the door on something even more haunting. Fire. Sudden, consuming, unforgiving. For some travelers, the scariest part of their journey wasn't a distant unknown. It was their bed, their room, the place they thought they were safest. In this episode, we're telling the stories of four devastating hostel fires. The Childers Palace Backpackers Hostel in Australia, where young backpackers from around the world came chasing sunshine and freedom and never made it home. The Down Under Hostel fire in Sydney, Australia, where a broken alarm system and locked exits turned a simple stay into a fatal trap. A fire in Riga, Latvia, swift and deadly, inside an illegal hostel that should have never been open at all. And the Loafers Lodge fire in Wellington, New Zealand, where residents living in budget rooms were left scrambling for their lives in the early hours of the morning. Each of these stories is different, but they all ask the same terrifying question. What happens when your escape route disappears? This isn't about fear, it's about awareness. Because travel should feel like possibility, not risk. Hostels should be places of laughter and late-night stories, not loss. So stay with me as we retrace the final hours inside these hostels. We'll ask what went wrong and what we can learn from the people who never got the chance to check out.
Hi there, we're Lauren
and Kenzie,
the co-hosts of A Scary State podcast.
Each week we cover a different state in the U.S. and we cover anything from murder mysteries,
strange disappearances,
paranormal activity,
cryptids,
or urban legends.
So if you're interested in learning about the spooky things in your state, give us a listen.
New episodes come out every Wednesday and you can find us anywhere you get your podcasts.
Stay scary.
Stay safe.
Before tragedy struck and its name became forever tied to one of Australia's worst hostel fires, Childers was, and still is, a place that backpackers found themselves drawn to. Not because it's flashy or world famous, but because it sits quietly and confidently along the main highway between Brisbane and Cairns, welcoming travelers with an easygoing pace, historic buildings, and a surprising depth of character. Childers is small, just a few thousand people, but what it lacks in size, it makes up for in soul. It's perched atop a ridge in the middle of sugarcane country, and when the sun hits the fields just right, it casts golden light across the landscape that feels almost cinematic. It's the kind of town that smells like molasses during cane crushing season, and where every second business is either a fruit packing shed or a cafe serving homemade scones. For backpackers, Childers isn't just a pretty detour. It's work, real work. Australia's working holiday visa requires travelers to do a stint of agricultural labor if they want to stay an extra year, and Childers is one of the main places they come to do it. Fruit picking, cane cutting, avocado packing. It's hard, dirty work in the hot sun, but it's also a rite of passage. You meet other travelers, you share cheap meals and war stories, and you stay in hostels like the Palace. Aside from work, visitors can visit the Flying High Bird Sanctuary, one of the largest aviaries in the Southern Hemisphere. There's the Snakes Down Under Reptile Park, where crocodiles, pythons, and dragons put on a show that's equal parts educational and terrifying. The Paragon Theater, a beautifully restored 1920s cinema that still screens movies under Art Deco chandeliers. There are wineries tucked just outside town offering sweet fruit wines that go down a little too easily on a hot day. Childers is the kind of town that feels quiet, safe, until one night in June 2000, when everything changed. If you were a young traveler making your way up or down Australia's eastern coast in the late 1990s or early 2000s, chances are you heard about the Palace. It was the kind of hostel that had a reputation, not necessarily for being the flashiest or the cleanest, but for being one of the liveliest. A stop on the unofficial backpacker circuit where stories were shared, friendships were fast-tracked, and hard day's work in the fields usually ended with a cheap beer and laughter echoing down the halls. The Palace Backpackers Hostel sat right in the middle of Childers on the main street, in a historic red brick building that had once been a grand hotel in the early 1900s. An old pub-turned hostel that gave the sleepy town a jolt of youthful energy. And you couldn't miss it. Ornate columns, wide upstairs balconies, the kind of structure that whispered stories, even in silence. Inside, the hostel had all the backpacker basics. Shared dorms, squeaky bunk beds, handwritten signs reminding people to wash their dishes, and a mix of international accents in the air. There were common areas for meals, games, or just lying around in the heat, swapping tales about farm work or long bus rides. And like so many hostels catering to the working holiday crowd, there was a sense of impermanence, of people just passing through. But that impermanence didn't mean it lacked community. In fact, the Palace was known for the opposite. Travelers made fast friends here. You could arrive knowing no one and find yourself pulled into a group dinner, a birthday celebration, or a late-night walk under Queensland's star-drenched skies. And part of the hostel's appeal was its location. You didn't need a car. You could roll your backpack down the street from the Greyhound stop, check in, and start work in the fruit fields the very next day. It was convenient, it was cheap, and it had that familiar, friendly chaos that backpackers find comfort in. Travelers from the UK, Ireland, South Korea, Japan, the Netherlands, France, and beyond all passed through those doors. But for all its charm, the Palace wasn't without flaws. The building itself was old. Beautiful, yes, but old. There was no sprinkler system, no working fire alarm in parts of the building. The upstairs windows were high and narrow, not designed for escape. And like many historic structures retrofitted into modern use, it didn't quite meet every safety standard. But few thought much of it. Fire drills, emergency exits, they weren't top of the mind when you're 20, sunburned, and tired from a day of farm labor. In online forums and archived travel blogs, there were flickers of early reviews. Some loved the vibe, Great people, awesome place, classic Aussie working hostel. Others noted the conditions. Mattresses are thin, kitchen gets crowded, needs a good clean. But even the gripes were delivered with that familiar traveler shrug. You get what you pay for. What travelers wanted was connection, and they got that. The palace was a house of stories, photos taped to the walls, names carved into bunk frames, a place that felt safe enough to let your guard down. But that illusion, the safety, the laughter, the sense of invincibility, shattered just after midnight on June 23rd, 2000. On a night like any other, with dozens of backpackers fast asleep in their bunks, a fire started in the downstairs lounge. It took only minutes for the smoke to fill the hallways, for the wooden floors and century-old walls to catch and roar. And in the chaos that followed, the screams, the pounding feet, the desperate leaps from second-story windows, 15 young lives were lost. 15 travelers who never made it home, who had come to Childers with dusty shoes and open hearts, chasing adventure, chasing a visa, chasing the wide open sky, only to be caught in something far darker than they could have ever imagined. What started as a place of rest and camaraderie became the scene of one of Australia's most devastating hostel tragedies. In the span of minutes, a sanctuary for wanderers turned into a smoke-filled maze of terror. And when the sun rose over Childers that morning, the town would never be the same again. 15 young travelers, 15 stories, each one unfinished, each one a thread in a much larger tapestry of loss, grief, and resilience. Who were they? What brought them to this quiet Queensland town? What dreams did they carry in their backpacks? Let's take a moment to honor those lives, not just the way they died, but the way they lived. Stacey Louise and Kelly June Slark, 22-year-old identical twins from Western Australia, were known for their close bond and shared love of travel. They'd been working in the Childers area to extend their holiday in Australia. Sarah Ann Williams, 23, hailed from Aberfan, Wales. She was planning to return home for her brother's wedding shortly after the fire. Michael Ernest Lewis, 25, from St. George, Bristol, England, was traveling with his friend, Gary Sutton. Claire Louise Webb, 24, of South Ascot, Berkshire, England, was remembered as a vibrant and adventurous spirit. Natalie Morris, 18, from Wales, had dreamed of visiting Australia. Her journey was just beginning when it was tragically cut short. Gary John Sutton, 24, from Tourton, Bath, England, was known for his friendly demeanor and love of travel. Melissa Jane Smith, 26, from Berkshire, England, had a passion for music and was often seen with her guitar. Adam John Rowland, 19, of St. Leonard's, East Sussex, England, was the youngest British victim, remembered for his enthusiasm and zest for life. Jolly van der Velden, 23, and Sebastian Westerveld, 22, both from the Netherlands, were traveling together, embracing the Australian backpacking experience. Julie O'Keefe, 24, from Ireland, was on a working holiday, enjoying the cultural exchange and new experiences. Atsuki Toyana, 31, from Japan, had come to Australia seeking new opportunities and adventures. Hai Kwang Lee, 23, from South Korea, was known for her determination and warmth, embracing the challenges of travel abroad. Moulay Lassen Laloui Kamal, 48, from Morocco, was the oldest victim, remembered for his kindness and wisdom shared with fellow travelers. These 15 individuals, from diverse backgrounds and cultures, shared a common spirit of adventure and exploration. Their lives were tragically ended in a fire that shocked the world and led to significant changes in hostel safety regulations in Australia. And before the fire, before the headlines, and before the heartbreak, there was a man, a drifter named Robert Paul Long. While the name may now be synonymous with destruction, the road to that night in June 2000 began much earlier, with a long trail of instability and deceit. Robert Paul Long was born in a suburb within the coastal city of Wollongong in New South Wales. His early years were not well documented, but what is known paints a picture of a troubled and chaotic life. From a young age, Robert seemed drawn to the margins of society. He was convicted of stealing women's clothing from clotheslines, an early sign of the strange and intrusive behavior that would later escalate. As he grew older, his criminal activity deepened. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison on charges that included burglary and assault. After his release, Robert never settled down. He led a nomadic existence, drifting across Australia without any real roots or long-term employment. He survived by taking on low-paying seasonal work, including fruit picking, a common job for transient workers and backpackers alike. And yet, even among that community of drifters, Robert stood out. He was known to spin elaborate lies about his past, often telling people he was terminally ill with cancer or that family members had died in tragic accidents. These stories weren't grounded in truth. They were tactics crafted to manipulate, to elicit sympathy, and to draw others in. In March 2000, Robert arrived in Childers and checked into the Palace Backpackers Hostel, blending in with the international mix of travelers who came to the area for adventure and work. For a while, he lived quietly enough, but there were warning signs. Fellow guests and hostel staff began to find him unsettling, his stories, his behavior, his mood swings. On June 14th, Robert was evicted from the hostel for failing to pay over $200 in rent. Now, that might have been the end of it, but Robert didn't leave town. Instead, he lingered. He was seen around the area, simmering with resentment. At one point, he reportedly told someone that if the locals didn't drive the backpackers out of Childers, he would. It wasn't an offhand comment. It was a threat. And just days later, he made good on it. Shortly before midnight, on June 23rd, 2000, witnesses saw Robert near the hostel. He watched, waited, and at some point, he slipped inside through an open door. At 12:24 a.m., the fire started in the downstairs television and lounge room near the front of the building. Accelerant was likely used. Investigators would later find multiple ignition points. Within minutes, the fire surged upward. The 100-year-old timber building was dry. It was the perfect fuel. The staircase, one of the few escape routes, was quickly engulfed. At 12:30 a.m., the smoke alarms failed to go off. There were no sprinklers. Most of the guests were asleep in their beds. Thick, toxic smoke filled the upper level in less than 3 minutes. At 12:32 a.m., the screams began. There was shouting and chaos. Some guests kicked out windows and jumped. Others crawled through dense smoke, blinded and choking. A few broke down doors to save their friends. At 12:35, the fire crews arrived. But by then, the building was a roaring furnace. Flames licked the roofline. Inside, it was already too late for some. Firefighters described it as one of the worst blazes they had ever seen. At 1 a.m., only 36 minutes after the fire started, the building was completely destroyed. 36 minutes. By sunrise, emergency crews had found 15 bodies. Young travelers, full of hope, working in Australia for a season of travel and adventure. Their families awoke to news they could never have imagined. The fire may have ended in the early hours of June 24th, but its smoke lingered, heavy, emotional, and unrelenting. Childers woke up to the realization that their quiet little town had just become the epicenter of one of Australia's deadliest hostel fires. In the hours after the blaze, survivors, many in shock, some barefoot, others wrapped in borrowed blankets, gathered on the streets across from what was now a smoldering ruin. Some stood in stunned silence. Others cried out the names of missing friends, hoping for answers that would never come. Local families, businesses, and community groups mobilized almost instantly. People opened their homes, donated food, clothing, and money. Volunteers set up crisis centers at the local cultural center and churches. Townspeople who had never met these young travelers suddenly found themselves comforting them like family. Mayor Bill Trevor would later recall it as the town's darkest moment, but also its most united. When authorities realized the blaze was deliberately lit, suspicion quickly turned to Robert Paul Long. A massive manhunt began, and after 5 days of hiding in the bushland around Childers, he was finally found. But even then, he didn't go quietly. When officers tried to arrest him, he attacked, stabbing a police dog and injuring one of the officers before being shot in the shoulder and taken into custody. In March 2002, Robert finally stood trial. To expedite proceedings and spare the victims' families a long and painful legal process, he was charged with 2 counts of murder and 1 count of arson. He was found guilty on all charges and sentenced to life in prison, with a minimum of 20 years before becoming eligible for parole. 15 lives were lost, dozens more forever scarred, and yet the man at the center of it all has never shown remorse. The fire at the Palace Backpackers Hostel was one of the most devastating acts of arson in Australian history. It shook the backpacking community, changed the way hostels were regulated, and left an undeniable scar in the town of Childers. Eventually, grief gave way to remembrance. The town did not try to erase what had happened. Instead, it built something beautiful in the ashes. In 2003, the restored building opened as the Childers Regional Art Gallery, and upstairs, a quiet, sacred space was created, the Palace Memorial. There, photos of the 15 victims line the walls. Smiling faces from Belgium, the UK, Ireland, Netherlands, Korea, and Australia. Their stories are shared, not as statistics, but as lives fully lived, however briefly. Outside, a tranquil garden blooms in their honor. It's a space for quiet reflection, a place where visitors and locals alike can come to remember the vibrant travelers whose journeys ended far too soon. When we think about hostels, we often picture bunk beds and backpacks, instant noodles cooked in communal kitchens, laughter echoing down narrow hallways. They're supposed to be places of freedom and discovery. The Palace Backpackers Hostel once was that, until one man's darkness shattered it all. The story of Childers is heartbreaking, but it's also a reminder of how quickly joy can turn to tragedy, of how deeply strangers can care for one another, and of how travel, for all its risks, remains a brave, beautiful act of hope. Sadly, Childers is not the only story like this. Just a few years later, a fire broke out in another Australian hostel, this time in Sydney. Another group of young travelers, another building that should have been safe, another night that changed everything. This is the story of the Down Under Hostel Fire.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's the late 1980s in Sydney. The air smells of salt and hot pavement. It's a city alive with contradictions. Glittering coastline and hardened back streets, golden beaches by day, and neon-soaked alleys by night. Sydney has always been a city that pulls people in. Young travelers, artists, drifters, dreamers. In the late 1980s, it was booming. Skyscrapers were pushing upward in the central business district, while the working-class terraces of inner suburbs like Newton and Surrey Hills were a little rough around the edges. It was long before they'd become gentrified havens. But to backpackers, the city's charm wasn't in its polish. It was in its edge. Backpackers came looking for that edge, and many found it in King's Cross. Known simply as The Cross, this was Sydney's red light district. Gritty, hedonistic, and impossible to ignore. The Cross wasn't pretending to be glamorous. It was all neon signs, XXX cinemas, nightclubs pulsing until sunrise, and a constant thrum of chaos. But beneath the seedy surface, there was a pulse of something else. Life. Real, messy, unpredictable life. The Cross was an unlikely hub for backpackers, but it made perfect sense. It was central, and never dull. You could walk out the door of a hostel and be surrounded by 24-hour diners, late-night kebab joints, used bookshops, and tattoo parlors. There were pubs where you could find live music 7 nights a week. Irish, German, and Canadian kids could be spotted leaning against the bar, sharing stories of the road. Sometimes they worked in nearby cafes or washed dishes under the table at divey restaurants for a bit of cash. Sometimes they didn't work at all. And that was part of the appeal. In King's Cross, no one asked too many questions. You could disappear into the crowd. You could become whoever you wanted to be. The Down Under Hostel, where our story takes place, was one of many no-frills backpacker joints packed into the narrow side streets branching off Darlinghurst Road. Back then, safety codes were looser, rooms were overcrowded, fire escapes were often blocked. But the price was right, and the vibe was pure camaraderie. During the day, backpackers would branch out across Sydney. They'd catch a ferry to Manly Beach, the wind blowing through their hair as the opera house shrank behind them. They'd hike along the coastal cliffs of Bondi to Coogee, or get blissfully lost in the markets of Glebe. Some ventured west to the Blue Mountains, just a train ride away, where eucalyptus mist hung like a spell over ancient stone. Others hung out in Hyde Park, sunbathing and scribbling postcards. And at night, they'd return to the Cross. They shared cheap beer, played music in hostel lounges, and swapped stories about travel, about home, about the future. In the Cross, there was always someone interesting to meet, always a corner of the city you hadn't discovered yet. But there was danger too. King's Cross had a dark underbelly, and everyone knew it. Police corruption was rampant in the late 1980s. The drug trade was thriving. People went missing here. Sex workers were often unprotected. There were whispers about brothels linked to organized crime, about backpackers who overdosed and were never heard from again. But that was part of the mythology. King's Cross was a place of extremes. And if you were young, maybe just a little naive, it felt like you were living in the center of the universe. That's what makes what happened so heartbreaking. Because in a big city as big and bright as Sydney, in a district that thrived on being anonymous and moving along, it was easy to feel invincible. Within that big city was an atmosphere of freedom and frugality at the hostels. They were more than just a bed. They were pressure cookers of youth, culture, and chaos, where strangers became friends overnight, and where the line between safety and risk sometimes blurred. The Down Under Backpackers was a hostel tucked away in Sydney's city center. Cheap, busy, no frills. The kind of place you ended up in because it was available, and maybe because someone said it was fine enough. Now, what happened there wouldn't become as infamous as Childers, but it left its mark. The Down Under Backpackers Hostel was the kind of place that didn't show up in guidebooks, not even the well-worn ones passed between backpackers on long train rides. But it didn't need to. Back in the 1980s, it ran on word of mouth, the kind of place someone in Brisbane or Cairns might recommend over beers. If you're headed to Sydney, stay the Down Under. It's cheap, central, nothing fancy, but it does the job. And for the shoestring traveler, that was enough. The Down Under was unassuming from the outside, a narrow, multi-level brick building wedged between shops and offices. The kind of place you could walk past 3 times without even noticing. It wasn't beautiful, it wasn't particularly clean, but it had beds, and that was all many were looking for. Inside, it was basic, what you'd expect from a backpacker hostel during a time when budget travel really meant budget. There were bunk beds lined up in shared rooms, maybe a single or two for couples or those willing to pay a few extra dollars. Rooms were small, humid, and often noisy, the kind of place where earplugs were a lifeline. There was a communal kitchen, simple, functional, always a bit chaotic. Mismatched cutlery, fridges that hummed loudly, shelves of instant noodles, and forgotten leftovers. At dinner time, the kitchen was alive with languages, clattering pans, and stories exchanged over cheap pasta and supermarket wine. The walls of the hostel were covered in posters, travel deals, handwritten announcements, and fading flyers for pub crawls and fruit picking gigs. It had its cast of characters, long-termers who'd been there way too long, wide-eyed arrivals fresh from the airport, and staff who were often travelers themselves working for free accommodation. It was far from glamorous, but there was a strange kind of charm to it. For many, it was their first stop in Sydney, a place to catch their breath, to sleep off jet lag, to meet fellow travelers before moving on to something else. But there were issues, too. Some whispered, some just accepted as part of the deal. Doors that didn't lock properly, fire exits that were hard to find or blocked by luggage, rumors that staff had raised concerns about safety, about the stairwells, the wiring, the lack of clear emergency plans. But in the blur of daily hostel life, those concerns went unheard, buried under the noise of a full house and a tight budget. And it was full. The night of the fire, the Down Under was crowded. Dozens of travelers tucked into their bunks, some winding down for the night, others just heading out. The hallways were narrow, the stairwells steep. No one expected anything but another sticky, restless Sydney night. But that night wouldn't end the way it was meant to. The fire that swept through the Down Under hostel didn't have a name like Childers. It didn't make international headlines, but it was just as real, just as terrifying. And for those inside, just as life-altering. When we talk about tragedy, it's easy to focus on the fire itself, the horror, the chaos, the loss. But behind every headline are lives, real people with hopes, with stories, with plans for the future. On the night of September 17, 1989, six young travelers lost their lives in the Down Under hostel fire. Each of them had left home in search of something, adventure, love, connection, maybe even a little reinvention. So let's take a moment to get to know the victims. David Leo Hillman was 25 years old and from Canada. He had the kind of adventurous heart that draws people across oceans. He came to Australia not just for the sights, but for the experience. Open roads, open skies, new faces. Friends described him as kind, full of stories, and the type of person who was always ready to help someone out. He had a warmth that made you feel like you'd known him longer than you had. Jacinda Marie Hill, also 25, was from New Zealand. Bright, vibrant, and deeply in love. Jacinda was engaged to Alan Nielsen. She was the kind of person who lit up a room with her laugh, who made fast friends out of strangers. Traveling with Alan was a dream come true. They were planning a life together in Auckland after this chapter. Her energy, her spirit, it was magnetic. Alan Nielsen was 27, originally from Denmark. He was calm, grounded, and thoughtful, a steady presence to balance Jacinda's effervescence. Their love was strong, the kind that makes other people believe in the idea of soulmates. Alan had come to Australia with Jacinda as part of one last great adventure before starting their life back home. They were sharing a room in the hostel when the fire broke out. Darren Andrews was just 20 years old from the United Kingdom. Youthful, curious, and full of life. He had come to Australia the way so many young people do, eager to see the world, to feel free, to chase something bigger than himself. He made friends easily and filled his time with exploration, soaking up the moment with wide-eyed wonder. His journey was just beginning. One of the victims was a man from Austria, believed to be in his 20s. We don't know much about him. Not even his name has been confirmed in public records. But what we do know is this. He was a traveler far from home, choosing to sleep in a room full of strangers who, in a way, had become family. He had a story, and he mattered. The sixth victim was a 20-year-old man from Sweden. Again, his name hasn't been publicly released, but his presence tells us something universal. That urge we all feel to step out into the world and see it for ourselves. He is young, brave, and full of the quiet courage it takes to wander so far from the familiar. They all were. Six lives. Canada, New Zealand, Denmark, the UK, Austria, and Sweden. Six journeys interrupted. Six futures unfulfilled. But for a brief moment, they shared the same space. They crossed paths in the winding streets of King's Cross, in that chaotic and colorful corner of Sydney. They laughed under the same roof, slept in the same background hum of city traffic. They were part of a small international family, bound together by youth, by dreams, by the road. And now they're part of our memory. We say their names, we honor their stories, we remember them not just as victims of a fire, but as people who lived. But before the flames, before the smoke thickened the halls of the Down Under hostel and turned a budget backpacker's dream into a tomb, there was a man named Gregory Allen Brown. He was not a man of notoriety, not even particularly memorable. At 31 years old, Gregory drifted through Sydney's underbelly like a ghost, the kind of figure you'd pass on the street and forget 5 steps later. He was someone who didn't quite belong anywhere, but found a place, for a time, among the shadows of King's Cross in the late 1980s. Gregory was born in Queensland, though much of his early life remains unrecorded, lost in the kind of obscurity that often marks the lives of those who fall through society's cracks. What we do know is this. From a young age, he struggled. He reportedly suffered brain damage as a child. Whether from trauma, illness, or accident, the records don't say. But whatever the cause, it left a mark. He was said to have borderline intellectual functioning. And when psychologists later evaluated him, they noted signs of a personality disorder. Gregory would later be diagnosed with a condition known as factitious disorder, meaning he had a compulsion to lie about himself, to invent stories, often for sympathy or attention. It wasn't malicious, but it was destabilizing. He spun tales, some elaborate, some oddly mundane. And as those around him tried to piece together the truth of who he was, the pieces never quite fit. In King's Cross, where the neon lights blinked endlessly and the line between survival and collapse was razor thin, Gregory moved between hostels and temporary shelters. He lived on the margins. At times, he tried to hold jobs, but nothing stuck. He battled addiction, substance use, and his own demons. Though whether those were psychiatric or circumstantial is still a matter of debate. Gregory wasn't a registered guest of the Down Under at the time of the fire, but he'd stayed there before. He knew its layout, its vulnerabilities, the lack of fire exits, the narrow stairwells, the shared sleeping quarters on upper floors with only one main path of escape. In a neighborhood full of strange characters, he was just one more. Someone people saw but didn't really see. In the days leading up to the fire, Gregory was angry. A minor dispute over a bed, a disagreement with management. Those were the most cited reasons. But in his unstable mind, that slight festered. Whether out of revenge, frustration, confusion, or something else entirely, he made a choice. In the early hours of September 17th, 1989, he returned to the Down Under hostel. Witnesses would later say they saw him loitering around the building that night, standing in the shadows, mumbling to himself. Just after 3:30 a.m., fire broke out in a storage room on the second floor. Within minutes, the flames had spread, racing up the stairwell, turning the wooden beams into torches. And while the chaos unfolded, Gregory quietly disappeared. Later, when he was picked up by police, he confessed. Not just to this fire, but to hundreds of others. 500, he claimed. The number alone would cast doubt on his mental state. Investigators questioned whether he'd truly been at the scene. Some said he had fled to Melbourne by then. Others believed he was exactly where the evidence said he was. Inside the building, watching it burn. He was charged with 6 counts of murder. Ultimately, a court found him guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. And for that, he served 18 years. He was alleged to have boasted to another prisoner, "I love hearing people scream and watching them die." Gregory Allen Brown was released in 2009 after serving his full sentence, refusing to apply for parole. Unfortunately, that's not where his story ends. He relocated to Tasmania in 2022. He was convicted of attempting to involve a minor in the production of child exploitation material, receiving a suspended 12-month prison sentence. But after allegations emerged that Gregory had fabricated aspects of his personal history to secure a more lenient sentence, this led to a charge of perverting justice. He pleaded guilty to this charge on September 17th, 2024, exactly 35 years after the Down Under hostel fire, and he's currently awaiting sentencing. The Down Under hostel fire was over in minutes, but its echoes stretched across 6 continents. 6 young lives, each drawn to Sydney in search of discovery, freedom, and adventure, were instead remembered through obituaries and charred belongings. their families scattered across the UK, Germany, and New Zealand received phone calls that no one is ever prepared for. Grief, like fire, is indiscriminate and consuming. The news hit hard. In the weeks and months that followed, the community around King's Cross mourned, but also hardened. Questions were asked, many without answers. How did a man like Gregory Allen Brown slip through the cracks for so long? Why weren't there fire escapes? How many other hostels across Australia were just as vulnerable? There were protests. There were promises of reform. Building codes were examined. Fire safety standards reviewed. But for the parents who flew in to collect their children's remains and stare into the blackened husk of the hostel, it was all too late. The Down Under fire became a cautionary tale, told in the margins of travel forums and guidebooks. A hushed warning, rarely making headlines, but passed on from traveler to traveler. And yet, the impulse to travel, to explore, to connect, never stops. What happened at the Down Under hostel wasn't unique. Fires and budget accommodations have a long and grim history. Some are accidents. Some, like Childers and the Down Under, are deliberate. And some are a cruel mixture of negligence and tragedy. Thousands of miles away, in the heart of Latvia's capital city, another fire would strike. Another hostel. Another night of horror. But this one wasn't tucked away in a back alley or a low-profile part of town. It was right in the center of Riga. Modern, bustling, and seemingly safe. The year was 2021, and the city, like much of the world, was still reeling from the pandemic. But inside one particular hostel, something went wrong. Horribly wrong. Next is the fire at the Regal Illegal Hostel and the lives it took.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Riga in 2021 was a city of contrasts. The capital of Latvia sits at the crossroads of old and new, east and west, where medieval spires cast long shadows over sleek glass towers, and cobblestone alleys lead to booming bars, boutique hotels, and art galleries, alive with color. It's the kind of place that feels like it shouldn't exist. Too picturesque to be real, too complex to fully understand on a single visit. By 2021, Riga had become a quietly rising star in the European backpacking trail. It offered all the things that budget travelers craved: affordability, beauty, culture, and that whisper of edginess you don't get in more polished cities like Vienna or Amsterdam. For digital nomads, Riga was a dream. Superb Wi-Fi, cheap rent, strong coffee, and a certain no-questions-asked vibe that allows you to stay anonymous. Now, Riga isn't all charm and romance. Beyond the old town, the mood changes. Soviet-era apartment blocks stretch into the skyline. Nightclubs thump until sunrise. And tucked between all this are hostels. Some official, licensed, and pristine. Others, less so. Due to the pandemic restrictions, many hotels were technically banned from operating. Latvia had outlawed unlicensed tourist accommodations in an effort to control COVID-19. But the rules were porous, and some hostels stayed open, quietly, sometimes illegally, offering cash-only rates and no questions asked. It was in one of these places, hidden just a few blocks from the center of Riga's old town, that something would go terribly wrong. A fire, a fast, deadly blaze. 10 people would die. Before we talk about the fire and the victims, let's talk about the hostel itself and how it managed to operate in the shadows. The building at 1 Merkele Street looked unassuming. A gray century-old structure with a chipped facade and faded signage, tucked into a busy street just across from Riga's central train station. And from the outside, it looked like any number of budget accommodations that spring up near transit hubs in cities across Europe. quietly decaying, faintly anonymous, offering a bed to those just passing through. But this wasn't just any hostel. The sleeping pods were sectioned off with curtains or thin plywood, wedged into the old building's upper floors with little thought given to exits, airflow, or safety. There was only one staircase, no fire escape, no working smoke detectors, and it was illegal. Latvia had cracked down on unlicensed hostels and tourist accommodations, but enforcement was inconsistent. As tourism cautiously resumed, places like this found ways to reopen quietly, booking guests through international travel websites, accepting cash under the table, and avoiding inspections. People stayed here because it was cheap, really cheap, 10 euros a night, sometimes less. For that price, no one expected much. The online listings featured wide-angle photos of bright rooms, minimalist furniture, and glowing five-star reviews that didn't always match reality. In truth, it was a fire trap. But for many, that just didn't matter. The hostel catered to a strange mix of guests. Yes, there were tourists, mostly solo backpackers, drawn by price and proximity to Riga's old town. But there were also long-term residents, migrant workers from Ukraine or Belarus, locals down on their luck, and international drifters with nowhere else to go. For them, the hostel wasn't a stopover. It was home, even if only for a little while. Many were cramped into rooms without windows. The partitions made it feel private, but in truth, the building was a maze of plywood corridors and makeshift walls. The hostel sprawled over the upper floors of the building, right above a gambling hall and a kebab shop, businesses that stayed open late and might not have noticed the quiet flow of guests upstairs. Safety was an afterthought. One guest later described the air as stale, recycled, heavy. Another recalled the constant smell of cigarette smoke, and while there was technically a no-smoking rule, it was often ignored. There were no sprinklers, and worse, no warning systems. And yet people came. They came because Riga was beautiful, because life on the road is unpredictable, because for many travelers, especially in Eastern Europe, places like this are just part of the experience. A little rough, a little risky, but tolerable for a night or two. It was just one more story to tell. A weird hostel with some quirks, nothing more. But on a night in April of 2021, everything would change. The building, the guests, the hidden risks, everything came to a head in the dead of the night. What happened next would horrify a city and ignite a national debate over accountability, illegal rentals, and the true cost of turning a blind eye. It was just before dawn on April 28th, when smoke began to pour from the third floor of the building. Flames were soon visible from the street below, flickering across soot-blackened windows as emergency crews rushed to the scene. Inside, chaos unfolded. Rooms filled with smoke, narrow hallways became choke points, and terrified guests clawing for visibility in a building with no functioning fire alarms. The hostel was crammed with bunk beds and makeshift sleeping spaces. It was unlicensed and illegally run, with residents packed closely together in a space that lacked both oversight and safety protocols. Despite multiple attempts by the State Fire and Rescue Service to inspect the premises, access was repeatedly denied. Residents had reported issues ranging from overcrowding to drug use, and the building had been fined for non-compliance with safety regulations. On that fateful morning, the fire quickly spread from the fifth floor to the sixth and onto the roof. Survivors described being awakened by an explosion and seeing orange light beneath their doors. The building's lack of functional fire alarms and emergency exits turned the structure into a deadly trap. The blaze spread fast, fed by combustible furnishings and a lack of fire-resistant barriers. Firefighters arrived at 4:43 a.m. But by then, the blaze had engulfed the upper floors. 9 people lost their lives. 24 others were evacuated from the burning building, 6 of whom were hospitalized with moderate injuries. The aftermath was harrowing. Many of the victims were burned so badly that identification became a prolonged and painful process. For days, the building stood destroyed behind police tape, its charred upper floors a silent testament to the chaos that had unfolded there. Authorities would later confirm that all 9 of those who died were Latvian citizens. Despite intensive investigations and public appeals, their names were never released. Whether for privacy, ongoing investigations, or the difficulty of positive identification, their identities remained shielded from public view. Still, we know this much. They were sons and daughters, friends and workers, people with histories, habits, and hopes. Some were likely staying just a night or two in the heart of the city. Others had been there for weeks, maybe months, seeking refuge in a building that promised cheap shelter but delivered danger. What happened was not just a tragic fire. It was the fatal result of neglect, desperation, and the failure of oversight. A quiet, crumbling structure transformed into a death trap, claiming lives in silence and flame. In the days that followed, as Riga mourned and investigators picked through the ashes, the city was forced to reckon with what it had overlooked for too long. These were not just unnamed casualties of a forgotten building. They were people who deserved safety, dignity, and a tomorrow that never came. In the wake of the devastating fire, Latvian authorities launched a comprehensive investigation to determine accountability. Initially, 6 individuals were detained in connection with the incident. However, as the investigation progressed, charges were ultimately brought against 2 key figures: businessman Ernest Rakes and his associate Andrei Gelas. According to the indictment presented by the Riga District Prosecutor's Office, Ernest and Andrei conspired to expand their accommodation business by purchasing adjacent properties and converting them into a hostel without obtaining the necessary permits or adhering to safety regulations. Between October 2019 and April 2021, they operated the establishment illegally, accommodating between 34 to 68 individuals simultaneously without registering the business or paying taxes. The hostel's unauthorized renovations included the creation of 34 separate rooms, lacking proper fire safety measures. Despite multiple complaints and inspections by authorities, the operators continued their activities, ignoring orders to cease operations. Now, following the fire, Ernest evaded authorities, prompting an international search. He was eventually arrested in June 2021. However, in April 2024, he failed to appear in court, leading to a warrant for his arrest being issued once again. Charges against the 2 men included conducting business without registration and willful violation of fire safety regulation, resulting in multiple deaths. If convicted, they only face up to 8 years in prison. 9 people died in that fire. Some never even woke up. Others tried to crawl through the smoke, blinded and suffocating. For many of them, Riga had been a stop on a journey, an affordable place to lay their heads. Some were trying to rebuild their lives, and some were just passing through. But the place they had trusted to keep them safe wasn't a hostel at all. It was a building gutted and restructured without permits, packed beyond capacity, with no fire exits, no sprinklers, and ultimately no escape. The weeks that followed, Riga was forced to reckon with what had been hiding in plain sight. Because this wasn't just one illegal hostel, it was part of a deeper rot. An industry of underground accommodations offering cut-rate lodging with none of the protections guests have a right to expect. This prompted police to conduct wide-scale checks on short-term rentals and hostels across the capital. Unregistered businesses were shut down, fire safety regulations were reviewed and strengthened, and the victims became more than just numbers in a news report. They became a call to action. But change hasn't come easily. Even now, years later, the question lingers. How did this happen in the heart of a European capital? And how many more places like this still exist, quietly ignoring safety laws, putting profit over lives? Now, there are no easy answers, but in remembering what happened, we can name the cost of indifference. And we can say with conviction that safety isn't optional. It's a right that every traveler, every person seeking shelter is entitled to, no matter how short the stay. And with that, we turn from the cold, cobbled streets of Riga to the green hills and seaside winds of New Zealand. Because even in countries with some of the world's highest safety standards, the unthinkable can still occur.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
At the bottom of New Zealand's North Island, where the land narrows and the sea pulls away toward the Cook Strait, sits a city that hums with quiet defiance. Wellington, New Zealand's capital, is compact, creative, and carved into hillsides, a place where the weather is wild and the people are warmer than you'd expect. They call it the Windy City, and it earns the name. With strong gusts funneling in from the sea, there are days when it feels like the entire town is about to be blown uphill. Umbrellas don't last long there, and neither do bad ideas. Wellington is practical, artsy, a little eccentric, and fiercely proud of what it is. Backpackers love it, not just because it's a hub for travelers going north or south, but because Wellington has heart. It's where you'll find secondhand bookstores tucked between vintage record shops and late-night cafes buzzing with live jazz. It's a place where film lovers geek out over The Lord of the Rings because much of it was filmed nearby. You can take the cable car up to the Botanic Garden, wander past hillside homes that cling to the cliffs, or sip flat whites in eclectic cafes. Some of the city's quirks are endearing, like the sculpture of a man in a suit doing a handstand on the waterfront. Others are more unexpected, like the fact that Wellington sits directly on a major fault line. Earthquakes are part of the landscape here, with emergency kits being a normal part of household life. And then there's the housing. Wellington, like much of New Zealand, has struggled with an ongoing housing crisis. Shortages of affordable rentals and long waitlists for public housing have left many vulnerable people with few options. Now, in that vacuum, hostels, especially long-stay ones, have become more than places for tourists. They've become semi-permanent homes for people in transition, seasonal workers, pensioners, migrants, and those with nowhere else to go. Places like Loafer's Lodge. Now, it was never meant to be glamorous, and for many, it was a roof, a room, a chance to get back on their feet. Until one night in May 2023, when everything changed. Loafer's Lodge stood on Adelaide Road in the suburb of Newtown, just a short walk from Wellington Hospital. From the outside, it was unremarkable. Three stories of plain, beige siding, boxy structure with long, narrow windows and a utilitarian feel. The kind of building you might pass without giving it a second glance. But behind its locked doors was another world entirely. Loafer's Lodge wasn't your average hostel. It wasn't where young backpackers stayed while ticking off bucket list hikes. It wasn't social, trendy, or bohemian. It was a place that served a different purpose. It was a safety net. With around 92 rooms and a capacity for over 100 people, Loafer's Lodge operated as a long-stay budget accommodation, part hostel, part boarding house. It attracted a cross-section of Wellington's most vulnerable. It was meant to be temporary, a stepping stone, a place to stay just for now. But for many, Loafer's became the end of the line. Inside, the hallways were narrow and windowless, painted in neutral tones. The rooms were small and basic, just big enough for a bed, a shelf, and a few personal belongings. Bathrooms and kitchens were shared. There were cameras, locked doors, and a curfew. Smoking wasn't allowed in rooms, but residents often broke the rules. It wasn't luxurious, but it was dry, warm, and relatively cheap. Residents described it as quiet, even lonely. Some kept to themselves, others formed makeshift communities, little pockets of support among the overlooked. The night staff came to know everyone by name. The routines were familiar. The building felt tired, but stable. It had a rhythm, but it also had flaws. The building was not fitted with sprinklers. The fire alarm system required manual activation. There were three stairwells, but no central evacuation system or audible alarms. Safety, in theory, existed, but only if someone was awake to notice a threat. The Loafers Lodge operated legally, but quietly under the radar of public attention. Like many similar places across the country, it was part of an invisible system housing the people society doesn't often see. Until it all went up in flames. In the early hours of May 16th, 2023, a fire broke out inside. What began as smoke and flickering shadows quickly turned into a roaring blaze. Residents were trapped with no warning. What had been a hidden community, forgotten by most of the city, was suddenly at the center of a national tragedy. And the question everyone was asking, how did this happen? May 16th began quietly, just another night in Wellington. The wind had settled, the streets were still. Inside Loafers Lodge, most residents had turned in for the night. Around 10:30, a couch fire broke out on the third floor. It was extinguished without incident, and authorities were not notified. Then, at approximately 12:25 a.m., flames erupted again, with devastating consequences. The fire spread rapidly, fueled by the building's lack of fire suppression systems and compromised fire doors. Thick smoke filled the corridors, and the roof eventually collapsed. The residents awoke to chaos. Some were forced to jump from windows to escape the inferno. Others were trapped, their cries for help echoing into the night. Firefighters rescued several individuals from the roof, but for five residents, help came too late. Michael Eric Warlich, affectionately known as Mike the Juggler, was a beloved street performer in Wellington. Born on June 27, 1955, he grew up with an older brother and three younger sisters. As a child, he taught himself to juggle using oranges and lemons from the kitchen. In the late 1990s, after a stint working for the Wellington City Council, Mike took to the streets to share his juggling talents, becoming a fixture in areas like Manners Mall, Lambton Quay, and Cuba Street. Dressed in his signature blue jumper and baggy pants, his performances brought joy to countless passerbys over nearly three decades. Despite facing personal challenges, including a serious assault in 2022, Mike remained a symbol of resilience and positivity. At age 67, his untimely death in the fire was mourned by many. A public funeral, attended by over 120 people in person and 300 online, highlighted the profound impact he had on the community. At 68, Melvin Perun was remembered as a dedicated criminal lawyer and a passionate tennis player. A former practitioner in the Wellington District Court, colleagues described him as kind, engaging, and committed to justice, often taking on challenging cases. Melvin's love for tennis saw him coaching in Germany, and he was the brother of the renowned New Zealand tennis player, Ani Perun. Known for his eccentric and infectious laugh, Melvin sought to uplift those around him. His passing in the Loafers Lodge fire was a significant loss to both the legal and broader communities. Peter O'Sullivan, age 64, was another victim of the tragic fire. His inclusion among the deceased underscores the diverse backgrounds of those affected by the tragedy. Peter's presence at Loafers Lodge suggests he was part of the community seeking affordable housing in Wellington. At 50, Liam Hawkins was known for his thoughtful nature and commitment to social cases. Liam was active in campaigns against the privatization of education in the late 1990s. He was also the brother of BBC presenter Lucy Hawkins. Liam's family expressed gratitude for the support received following his passing, reflecting the deep connections he maintained. Kenneth Bernard, age 67, was cherished by his family as a kind and gentle man. Described as a funny little kid who grew into a kindly man, Kenneth was adored by his nieces and nephews. His caring nature and patience left lasting impressions on those around him. Kenneth formed close friendships within the community. His friend, Tamra Isi Adan, an Ethiopian refugee, remembered him as a constant companion and a source of kindness. Kenneth's love for New Zealand and the people he lived with was evident in his daily interactions. These five men, each with unique stories and contributions, were united in their residence at Loafers Lodge. Their lives, though tragically cut short, serve as a testament to the diverse tapestry of individuals who formed their communities. In the aftermath of the fire, while smoke still lingered in the Wellington air and investigators combed through the wreckage, a question pulsed through the hearts of the city. Who could have done this? The answer would arrive faster than anyone expected. Within hours of the blaze being extinguished, police confirmed what many feared. They were treating the fire as suspicious. And within just a day, they had someone in their sights. His name was Brent John Livingston. At the time of the fire, Brent was 48 years old, a man with no fixed housing and a long, troubled history. He'd been living in Loafer's Lodge, and police would later say he'd been evicted from the building earlier that same day, reportedly after an altercation with another resident. Little is known publicly about Brent's childhood or early life, but court records and public statements paint a picture of a man plagued by instability, isolation, and volatility. He had a history of violence, antisocial behavior, and mental health struggles, including previous convictions for arson, property damage, and threatening behavior. According to police, Brent poured accelerant, believed to be gasoline, on the third floor, igniting the blaze. As flames spread rapidly through the aging wooden interior, dozens of residents were forced to flee for their lives, many barely escaping with the clothes on their backs. Some of the survivors remembered seeing him that day. One man recalled that Brent had muttered something about getting back at someone. By Wednesday afternoon, just over 36 hours after the fire, police arrested him not far from the charred hostel. When officers approached, he reportedly made no attempt to resist. He was initially charged with two counts of arson, one for the fire at Loafer's Lodge and another for setting fire to a couch inside the building earlier that evening. But as the extent of the devastation became clear, so did the scope of the charges. Eventually, he was charged with five counts of murder. The case shook New Zealand to its core. Prime Minister Chris Hipkins visited the site. Families mourned, and the city of Wellington was left wondering how someone like Brent had fallen through so many cracks. As of now, Brent John Livingston remains in custody awaiting trial. The court process has been slow as prosecutors prepare for one of the most significant murder cases in recent New Zealand history, and he has pled not guilty. In the coming months, the country will hear more about his mental health, his past, the warning signs that may have been missed. But no matter what's said in that courtroom, for those who lost loved ones, and for those who barely made it out alive, one thing will always remain. That fire didn't just destroy a building. It shattered lives. People from opposite corners of the world sharing bunk beds, trading travel tips, clinking beers, swapping life stories deep into the night. Hostels are the places of beginning, of adventure, of escape, of finding yourself. But the fire at Loafer's Lodge was a gutting reminder that even these communal, vibrant spaces are not immune to tragedy. That beneath the surface of any building, any city, there can be risks we don't always see. Vulnerabilities left unattended, people struggling quietly, systems that fail before anyone notices the cracks. What happened in Wellington wasn't just a fire, it was a rupture, a loss of five lives, each one of them unique, with dreams, routines, favorite meals, people they loved. But this reflection isn't meant to provoke fear. It's meant to ignite awareness, because travel is still one of the most hopeful things we can do. Hostels still open their doors to dreamers and wanderers from around the world. The answer isn't to stop traveling or to shy away from shared spaces, but to ask more questions, to look around, to understand where we stay, how it operates, who else it shelters. In the wake of the Loafer's Lodge fire, Wellington began that reckoning. Inspections were tightened, laws were reviewed, voices that had been ignored for too long were finally heard. And across New Zealand and beyond, others took note. Because tragedy, when acknowledged, can become a catalyst. A chance to do better, to protect the vulnerable, to honor those we lost by ensuring the same story doesn't repeat. So if you ever find yourself in a creaky hostel in some corner of the world, pause. Appreciate its life, its imperfections, the company it keeps. Be curious, be cautious, but don't stop going, because the world is still worth seeing. And sometimes even the most fragile places become the backdrop for the strongest stories.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
There's something undeniably special about hostels. They're not just places to sleep. They're places where lives overlap, where you can cook dinner with someone from Ireland, swap music with a traveler from Japan, or head out on a city walk with a stranger who becomes a lifelong friend. As a solo traveler myself, some of the most comforting and empowering moments of my journeys have taken place in hostels, especially when I found myself surrounded by other solo women, all choosing to explore the world on our own terms. There's a sense of solidarity in those shared kitchens and bunk-filled rooms, a belonging that can feel rare in a world that often tells women to be careful, to stay small, or not go too far alone. But part of that belonging, part of being safe, is also about being prepared. And that's where this conversation turns. Because while hostels can be magical, the stories I've told in this episode are hard reminders that safety isn't always guaranteed. Fires have struck hostels across the world, from the Palace Backpackers Hostel in Childers, where 15 young lives were stolen in a blaze set by a man who had no business being there, to the Down Under Hostel in Sydney, where fire ripped through the building, trapping residents and leaving 6 dead, to the Riga Hostel fire, where a mix of negligence and illegal aberrations cost 9 more lives. And finally, to Loafers Lodge in Wellington, where 5 people, some just beginning new chapters, never made it out. In every one of those fires, there were red flags. Broken smoke detector, blocked exits, overcrowded rooms, buildings not meant for the number of people staying in them. And in some cases, arsonists who should have never had access to vulnerable spaces. So let's talk about how to travel smart, how to stay in hostels and stay safe. Here are a few things I've learned, some from experience, some from research, and some from heartbreak. And when you check in, check out the exits. Know where the emergency doors are. Count the steps from your bed to the closest one. If you're in a dorm, trace your path in the dark in your mind. It sounds extreme until it isn't. Test the smoke detectors. Many hostels don't mind if you politely ask about their fire safety systems. If there's no visible alarm or the staff seems dismissive, consider that a red flag. Travel with a small flashlight. It sounds old school, but in an emergency, especially in unfamiliar buildings, a light can make all the difference. Keep it near your bed, along with your essentials, phone, shoes, ID. Choose hostels with clear safety ratings. Read reviews. Look for mentions of fire drills, cleanliness, locked doors, staff presence. Don't just pick the cheapest spot. And trust your gut. If a building feels run down, overcrowded, or just off, it's okay to leave. Your safety is worth more than a booking deposit. If you see something dangerous, say something. Whether it's a broken alarm, a blocked fire escape, or someone suspicious, hostels are communal spaces, and we're all responsible for each other. But I'll also say this from the heart. Don't let these stories make you afraid to travel. I've met some of the kindest, funniest, most generous people in hostels. I've been invited to weddings, shared tears over late-night dinners, danced on rooftops under string lights and stars. Most hostels are safe, most people are good, and most memories are beautiful. I tell these stories not to scare you away, but to remind you that vigilance doesn't cancel joy. Awareness doesn't mean fear. And travel, even in its most budget-friendly form, is worth every second. So pack your bag, book that bunk. Just take a moment to notice the exits and keep chasing the world. Four fires, four cities, dozens of lives, young, old, searching, settled, gone in an instant. In Childers, the flames were set by a man with a dark obsession, a stranger among travelers who were chasing the freedom of the open road. In Sydney, the Down Under hostel fire burned through the heart of King's Cross, destroying not just a building, but a fragile sense of safety for six souls who were simply looking for a rest. In Riga, it was neglect, a building that should have never housed guests, locked doors, overcrowding, warnings unheeded. And in Wellington, a fire that should have been preventable, a man with a history, a building full of people just trying to survive. What binds these stories isn't just the tragedy, it's the human element. Each victim had a name, a voice, a dream. They were backpackers on gap years, men restarting their lives, women finding their independence. They were someone's child, someone's friend, someone's roommate who'd saved them a top bunk. These fires weren't accidents. They were failures of people, of systems, of regulations. And while it's tempting to say that was far away or that could never happen here, the truth is it could and it has. But this isn't a call to fear. This is a call to remember, to be aware, to look out for each other when we travel. Because in hostels, we're not just sharing rooms, we're sharing responsibility. And it's also a reminder that despite what we've explored in this episode, hostels remain places of connection, courage, and community. That's where stories begin, where strangers become travel companions, where we find out we're braver than we thought we were. So as you book that bunk bed, sling your backpack over your shoulder, and head into the unknown, do it boldly, do it wisely, and do it with the memories of those we've lost tucked gently beside your guidebook. They didn't get to finish their journeys, but you can keep going for them. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/The Last Trip Podcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.